Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of my favorite guests on this program over the years has been Josh Willis. Josh is an oceanographer and climate scientist from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. He's done groundbreaking work studying how the Atlantic Ocean's warming waters are melting Greenland's glaciers from below, and he's a great science communicator. Josh has a flair for lighthearted conversation about a very heavy subject, climate change. While California is baking in record-breaking summer temperatures and a massive wildfire season, including the Park Fire that's literally near my backyard, it's the perfect time to have a cool conversation with my good friend, Josh Willis. Josh, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Oh, it's so good to be back. It's so good to talk to you again.
You know, I was thinking about you over the years, back when it was just a little four-minute show, back in the early 2000s, you were one of our first guests.
I remember that, you know.
I believe at that time, and we could talk about it as we go through your career here a little bit, you had received a presidential award as a promising scientist, as I recall. Do you remember that?
That's right. I was so young and full of hope and promise. And now here I am today. None of those things are true anymore. But no, I got the presidential early career award for scientists and engineers, and I got to go to Washington. I took my parents with me, and I got to shake hands with Obama, which was really cool.
Oh, that is cool. Okay, so as a kid then growing up in Texas, you're interested in science. And when did it become something you were really seriously want to pursue? And how did you get to California and start, you know, wanting to study? I saw that you initially wanted to study physics. Is that right?
Yeah. I studied physics in college as an undergraduate at the University of Houston. But I held on to some of my like creative like tendencies. I minored in theater when I was there. So I have a minor in theater as well as a BS in physics and math. And then I chased a girl out west. I met my now wife, Dixie, in college, and her family was out here in California. And so I got into grad school in physics at UCSD. And somewhere along the way, my professors realized before I did that I did not want to be a physicist. And they let me know this by failing me out of physics grad school.
So they just said, you know, this isn't for you. Adios.
Yeah, well, there were a couple tests involved that I may not have passed.
Okay.
It was a traumatic period.
It's one of those things where it worked out great in the long run because you're a fantastic oceanographer. When did you decide you wanted to pursue that? And I know you went to Scripps, correct? Tell us about your experience there.
Yeah, you know, I had just failed out of the physics program at UCSD, and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do because I had this strong drive to do science, to be a scientist, to discover things about the world or the universe. And but I didn't know what I wanted to study, and physics didn't want me. And it turned out that there was this brilliant oceanography school right down the hill from where I'd been studying for the first 2 years of grad school, the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. And lucky me, they took me, even though I failed out of the physics program, which they knew about. They took me and I started studying the ocean, and I found a real passion for understanding the Earth.
Yeah, and that's so important, especially if you're going to, you know, get a PhD and be a scientist. You've got to love it. You've got to have a passion and a flame for it. And so discovering the ocean is your passion. That's a big deal. Tell us a bit about, you know, what it was like to be at Scripps and to fall in love with the oceanography there.
Well, Scripps was a blast. I mean, it was, I realized very quickly once I got there that it wasn't just this random research institution attached to the university. It actually was there before the university. UC San Diego grew out of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and it was a world-renowned place. It was doing really interesting stuff, and people were really just starting to dive into climate change as a field of study. Oceanographers, you know, had spent decades studying the tides and the big currents and how the ocean moves heat around. But nobody was really studying. They were just beginning to study how the oceans fit into the global warming picture. And that's when I found something that I thought, this is what I want to spend a career doing.
And the oceans are they're the most important component of climate change, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm sure you would agree, because the oceans are the giant heat reservoirs for the Earth. They store so much thermal energy.
Yeah. I mean, over 90% of the heat that we're trapping with the greenhouse gases is actually warming the oceans. You know, we think of the air heating up as climate change, but really, climate change is happening in the oceans. We're just along for the ride.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about your path that led you to NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. How did you wind up there?
Well, I had this really amazing advisor. His name is Dean Remick at Scripps. And at the time, there was this still fairly new satellite called Topex Poseidon that was measuring the sea level from space very accurately. And this satellite was useful for a bunch of reasons. Whenever the oceans heat up, the water literally expands and it stands taller. And the satellite measures that. It also told us about currents and things. But I was interested in trying to figure out what it could tell us about how the ocean was heating. And so I put my focus on trying to calculate this number, how much energy are the oceans absorbing? And I did one of the first calculations where we combined data from the satellite with direct measurements of temperature in the ocean, and we came up with a number, a really big number for how much the oceans are warming.
Wow. And to kind of lead us through some of your highlight missions you worked on while you've been at JPL.
Yeah. So, you know, the connection to the satellite led me to get a permanent job at JPL after graduate school. And I've been studying sea level really ever since. And I became the project scientist, which is sort of the lead NASA scientist for these sea level missions, which got me my PhD in grad school. And I was watching the oceans rise, but really, you know, the big question is how much are they going to rise in the future? How quickly are they going to rise in the future? And it's very clear that the biggest potential for future sea level rise is in Greenland and Antarctica, the huge ice sheets that have locked away many tens, hundreds of feet of potential sea level rise by this ice, which is sitting on land. So I also started a mission called Oceans Melting Greenland, or OMG for short, where we flew around and tried to understand how much the oceans were eating away at Greenland's ice from below.
And you found that they really, it's a profound effect, isn't it?
Yeah. More than half of the speed up, or about half of the speed up of the glaciers can be explained by actually just the warming of the water around the glaciers. So this ice in Greenland, it sits on the land, but it reaches the water, it reaches the sea, and a huge part of the glacier is actually sitting below sea level. So a lot of these glaciers sit in hundreds and hundreds, sometimes even thousands of feet of water. And as that water warms up, it eats away at the underside of the glacier. And this is actually causing the ice to evacuate more quickly from the land and raising sea levels in the long run. So the acronym proved to be right on the money. The oceans are melting Greenland.
And that mission is technically ended, but are you still monitoring, you know, what's going on in Greenland and working on that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we pretty clearly concluded that the oceans are important for how fast the ice is going to retreat. So we have to keep measuring the oceans, and I'm working on a small project with some local Greenlandic scientists, scientists at NOAA, and a couple other folks to keep observing the oceans offshore of Greenland. We call it Greenland Ocean Observations, or GOO for short.
You're good at these acronyms. OMG, goo.
Well, you know, I figure I gotta look at these things for a long time. They might as well entertain me.
Yes. Let's talk about some of the basic physics of the ocean. You do a really cool demonstration, or you have done it, and I love it, where you take a water balloon and a regular balloon and a big lighter that you'd use to light a barbecue with, and you light the balloon that's just air in it, and of course, you know, it pops immediately.
Bang.
But then you put the flame on the water balloon, and, you know, you'd have people thinking, oh, you know, this water balloon's going to explode all over me as soon as that melts out because it's hot. And yet, what happens?
The water balloon does not pop. But of course, you know, you got to have some you got to have some theater around it. So I usually pull out a bucket and put on a raincoat and, you know, kind of make a show of it. But in fact, you can try this at home. A water balloon actually over a flame won't pop. Now, if you get the little, you know, flamethrower, like little blowtorch lighters that have a lot of pressure, they can pop the balloon. But a regular flame, you know, a regular lighter, the balloon will not pop. And the reason is that the water is absorbing so much of that heat so quickly, the rubber actually doesn't have time to melt. It's a reminder of just how much heat water can absorb. You can do an experiment at home too. You can actually, we used to do this as a Boy Scout. You can boil water in a paper cup. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. The water is so good at absorbing the heat, the paper cup won't burn.
Well, and of course, if anybody's accidentally left a pan on the stove with no water in it, knows that that pan gets very, very hot.
Yes.
And, you know, it can be a very dangerous situation.
Yeah, don't do that.
It's only when you've got water or liquid that, you know, has water in it, in the pan, that, you know, it's okay. So just, it shows you the basic physics of the absorption of heat by water. It can take in a lot of heat energy without actually changing temperature very much.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We call it heat capacity. Mm-hmm. And water has one of the biggest heat capacities of anything we know.
Yeah, it's an amazing property of water. Okay, well, let's talk about what's going on with the oceans now. We know that as the oceans heat up, they expand, right? Can you explain to us, you know, the basics of the thermal expansion of the oceans? How does that work?
Yeah, you know, it's a lot like a metal, right? You know this from when you were a kid and the thermometers used to have mercury in them, right? You put the thermometer in your mouth and the mercury literally expands and it goes out to some tick mark on the little glass thermometer, and that's how you know that you're staying home from school that day. But water does exactly the same thing. It actually expands as it gets warmer. And that makes it stand taller. And about a third to a half of modern day sea level rise is actually just this warming of the water. The water is absorbing all that extra heat, over 90% of what we're trapping. And that's literally raising the oceans.
And talk about how you go about measuring that, because you have some very, you know, space age tools to do it with there at JPL. How do you measure that expansion?
Yeah, so we have these really cool satellites. I've been working on these satellites my entire career. The first one was called Topex Poseidon. That's the one that got me my PhD. And it has a radar that looks down at the ocean. It bounces a radar wave off the surface of the ocean and times how long it takes to come back. It actually averages over a big area. You know, a lot of people, you imagine the ocean, there's all these waves and, you know, all this crazy stuff, but it averages over a big spot. The radar wave comes back and the satellite measures how long it took to go down and come back. And we know the speed of light and we know the position of the satellite really, really well because it has GPS and a bunch of other stuff. And so with those two things, you can figure out the height of the water, the location of the satellite and the distance of the satellite to the water. You can tell how tall the water is. And these satellites fly around in an orbit that repeats once every 10 days. And they give us a sort of a snapshot of the state of the ocean every week and change. And they've been doing that since the early 90s. And when we average over the whole globe, we can see this steady rise of human-caused climate change that's warming the oceans, melting the ice, and driving sea level higher every year.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with NASA oceanographer and climate scientist Josh Willis as we look at the state of Earth's oceans. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our visit with Josh Willis. Josh is an oceanographer and climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Do you know when we first really noticed that there was sea level rise? When were the first measurements that started to indicate, hey, there's something going on here?
Well, we've had tide gauges in different places around the Earth for well over 100 years. In fact, there's some kind of historical things. There's these ancient Roman tidal ponds where they actually the water would come up above the edge of the pond at certain times of the day during high tide. The fish would come in, they'd lock off a little gate, and then as the tide went out, the fish would stay in. So it was a means of fishing. But we know because they needed the tides to work, we can tell what level they were. And so we know actually that sea levels were very stable for about 2,000 years, nearly 2,000 years. And in the last 150 years, our tide gauges and a few other things have shown that sea levels around the globe all of a sudden started rising. And they're not just rising, they're rising faster and faster every decade. And we can really see that now in the last 30 years of the satellite data.
And over the course of your career, has the rate of sea level rise, the acceleration of sea level rise as you just described it, has that been something that surprised you, or was it something you were expecting? Or what can you say about the rate of sea level rise, you know, now that you've observed it for a long period of time?
Yeah, you know, I've been looking at sea level rise with this satellite data for 20 years now. And what's funny is that for a long time, the science community used this sort of average over the whole record to say how fast sea level was rising. And the number was always 3 millimeters per year. That was the average rate. But recently, we've taken a closer look and the record's gotten longer. And what's really happening is that we started calculating that number, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. But in the very early part of the record, the number was really 2. And then in the middle of the record, it was 3. And now it's 4, or really closer to 4.5. So the rate has actually increased during my career. And every decade, it's increasing more. So we're literally watching the rate of sea level rise increase every decade.
Has that been surprising to Earth scientists like yourself, or something you expected?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of both. You know, you kind of expect, well, the warming's getting faster. These ice sheets are responding more quickly. So you kind of expect it. But then in a way, it's still hard to accept. We said 3 millimeters per year for way longer than we should have. Really 3 millimeters per year was what it was in the mid 2000s. You know, it's 2024 now, and it's 4.5. And I think that kind of reluctance to change the way we talk about it is a form of kind of shock, on the scientific community's behalf, that, you know, this is a moving target, like all of climate change is.
It just seems to me, as somebody who has observed climate change since I first became aware of it in the 1980s, that things are just going a little bit faster and faster as time goes on, and much more dramatic than I even envisioned when I first started studying this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's like falling, really. When you first start falling, you're not going all that fast. And if if you don't have far to fall, you know, off the bar stool or whatever, then you it hurts when you hit the ground, but it's not terrible. But that's the thing about stuff that's accelerating. You know, the longer it goes on, the faster and faster it gets. And I think that's something we haven't really appreciated about climate change. You know, we think about it in terms of how much has changed, but really we should be thinking about it in terms of how fast is it changing? And that's what's getting scary.
Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about where on Earth that we are observing the most dramatic effects of sea level rise.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was talking to my colleague about this week, and there's a lot of news and a lot of discussion about these small Pacific islands, Tuvalu and other places around the Pacific, where their total land area for the whole country is, you know, 5 or 6 feet above sea level, something like that. And these places, they're facing existential threats. But those threats are still a decade or two decades or a few decades in the future. But in fact, actually, right here in the U.S., in the Southeast, we're seeing rates of sea level rise that are way faster than the global mean. And part of that is the ocean sort of moving heat around and these natural cycles. Part of it is the fact that the ice sheets sort of play this unfair game, sending a bit more sea level rise to some places and a bit less to others. But really, in places like Florida, you know, there was just a news article this week about a study that showed that a specific species of cactus has actually gone extinct because of sea level rise. You know, we're literally losing territory now. And places that are low and flat are suffering the fastest. You know, for a long time, these places, a lot of them have these sort of marshlands. And marshes can grow as sea level rises. So the land can actually grow with the sea until sea level rise gets too quick. And that's what's beginning to happen in the Southeast. In places like Florida, they're really beginning to see climate change that's outpacing even what nature can keep up with.
We're also observing effects, you know, here on the West Coast, too, with just beach erosion and erosion along the coastlines in general.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of some of our most famous beaches here in Southern California are managed. They put up barriers to collect sand. They'll take sand from offshore and add it to the beach. But in places where that's not happening, the beach is disappearing. And some places are just fighting these losing battles, trying to collect sand, trying to keep the coast like we used to know it. But in the long run, you know, you always lose that battle. You're just postponing the inevitable.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit to talk about the communications aspect of talking about your work, because it's something that you have really worked very hard on and have some professional training. You've been through a lot of, you know, you mentioned that you minored in theater and you've done a lot of improv work. Can you talk about how that is helpful to you as a scientist, as a communicator of your science?
Yeah, you bet. You know, I did that theater in college to sort of hold on to this dream I had as a child of acting and being, you know, being in or related, doing stuff around movies, which I always thought was really cool. And then in grad school, the dream died, honestly, you know, failing out of physics and trying to find something I could really focus on, like climate change. And then eventually I moved to Los Angeles. And part of me was sort of sad because here I was in the midst of, you know, Hollywood where dreams are come to life. And, you know, I was enjoying my time as a scientist, but I felt like there was this itch I wasn't scratching. And then one day I met a guy who told me to go take a class at Second City, the famous improv school started in Chicago. They had a school here in LA for a while. And I did, and it changed my life, changed the way I communicate about climate, and changed my hobbies by a huge amount.
Can you give us some examples of that? How has that affected the way you communicate? How has that changed it?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, you know, you'll hear this, you know, you'll see it on TV. Improv is like a cult. You know, people are like, ah, I took this class. It changed my life. But it really did. It helped me listen, I think, in real life more, because one of the most important things you do when you're doing improv is listen to what the other people are saying. If you're focused on yourself, then it's hard to come up with the next thing. But when you focus on the person you're improvising with, then it becomes like a conversation. And I think for me, that's what was beaten out of me in grad school. This idea that our communication shouldn't be just one way, that it should be a back and forth.
Yeah, because that's the natural way that human beings actually communicate. And yet, as you said, you know, for a lot of scientists, they just get used to, you know, I'm making a presentation kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, we spend a lot of time as scientists learning how to talk to each other and kind of forgetting how to talk to everybody else, you know. And I think for me, that the importance of a real dialogue was what opened up a kind of like a creative pathway in my brain that let me be a better scientist in the long run. I actually, you know, settled on the OMG name during one of my first improv classes.
Oh, really? OMG. Yeah. OMG, Josh.
OMG, exactly. I was like, you know, I was one of the oldest guys in the class, and all these youngins were on social media and spouting all these three-letter acronyms at each other over text. And I thought, if I want to connect with more than just scientists, I need something that connects with people. And OMG was it.
Well, and you also have one of my very favorite Josh characters, Climate Elvis. How was Climate Elvis born? When did he come along?
Well, Climate Elvis was born in a small ranch in Climate Elvis came about because I have sideburns, and I'm kind of a doughy middle-aged guy with dark hair and sideburns, and people would sometimes just call me Elvis or kind of joke around about it. And then one day I did a Reddit like Ask Me Anything interview, and I said, you know what, make my handle Climate Elvis. And they did. And then it kind of stuck. And then when I started doing OMG, I sort of took on the identity of Climate Elvis, and I started using it a little more. And then I think it was actually you, Dave, who told me about this amazing contest
The flame
was going
contest.
On the East Coast. The flame contest. It was a challenge put out by the Alan Alda Center for Science Communication on the East Coast. And they asked scientists to make a video answering a question asked by an 11-year-old. And you remember the question that year?
I do not. What was it?
It was, what is climate?
Aha. Well, I would think that would be pretty good for you.
Yeah, and you called me up. I remember actually I was driving home from Vegas, and you said, Josh,
wait a minute,
climate
wait a minute.
Elvis.
Elvis was driving home from Vegas.
Elvis was driving home from Vegas. Yeah, of course. You know, maybe I was always destined to be Climate Elvis. Maybe it was really part of my destiny, because we do like to go to Vegas. But yeah, and you said you got to do a video, and I had all these Second City friends. I sat down with my wife, and we wrote out the lyrics to a song, kind of to the tune of the Jailhouse Rock. One of my Second City buddies recorded the music. I recorded the audio. Another improv friend helped me create a video and found this wonderful young actress who appears in the video. And we made the Climate Rock, which you should Google and check out.
Hello there, little lady.
Say, what's climate?
Well, you curious little ankle biter.
Climate is the average of the weather you see. The critters and plants all know where to be. A cactus can't live in the tropical rain. And polar bears don't dig by rain. That's climate.
Wait a minute. So, are you saying that plants and animals know about climate too?
Well, that's right, little Miss Jane Goodall. Every living thing on Earth is adapted to the very specific climate that it lives in.
And I always enjoy visiting with climate Elvis. Even though, you know, I know he's getting older and, you know, you got to stay in shape, Elvis. We don't want anything to happen to climate Elvis like what happened to regular Elvis.
Well, that's right. I've been working out and going to the gym, Dave, every day.
Good, good. Okay, well, let's talk a bit about when you observe other scientists communicate. Are there any, do you have any mentors or, you know, scientific communications heroes that, you know, when you see them or listen to them or read from them, that you say, yeah, that's the way to do it. Any heroes for you?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I always watched PBS, and I remember actually from a very young age, I remember Captain Kangaroo. And this guy who, and I've looked him, you know, I've read about him since when I was a kid, he was just Captain Kangaroo, but he started off really as a clown. And I learned more about science from a clown than I did from, you know, a lot of my science teachers. and I realized that I think, you know, communicating about science, it's a different thing than practicing science and discovering things, doing science. But I think we all owe it to the public to be a little bit of a clown and to learn how to talk to people about what we do in a way that's exciting, that's fun, and that shares our sense of wonder, right? You know, we get excited about things that nobody else understands, but part of our job is to help people understand, and I think that's a responsibility for all scientists, especially climate scientists.
Yeah, let's talk about that in particular, because you are a climate scientist, and it presents its particular challenges, doesn't it? What are some of the hardest parts of communicating climate science that you've observed over the years?
Yeah, you know, I think for me, the hardest part is really trying to counter misinformation. There have been these enormous campaigns to try and convince people that it's not real, or that if it's real, it's not our fault, or even if it's our fault, that we can't do anything about it. And, you know, scientists are barely equipped to just explain what we're doing to the public. But to fight like a PR campaign against climate change, we're just not equipped for that. And so I think, to me, you know, when people find out I'm a climate scientist, they always ask me the same question: how bad is it? You know, some version of that. How bad is it, right? Because they kind of all know that it's real, but the misinformation is so sticky and so prevalent that it's hard for people to kind of untangle it all. And so, just explaining what's going on in a lot of times is the hardest part.
And any like poor practices you've seen over the years, not singling any people out, but, you know, sometimes when you see somebody, you know, giving a presentation or an interview or something like that, where you just kind of, oh, no, that's not how you do that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, the big one is jargon, right? Like I said, we spend all this time learning how to talk to each other and forgetting how to talk to everybody else. And a lot of what that process is learning these specialized words, and even worse, you know, specialized meanings for words we use every day.
Can you give me an example?
Standard deviation, right? You know, variance, mean, even the mean, right? The mean is like the average, right? It means something different to everybody else.
And that's just mean, Josh.
It is mean, right? There's too many means. Many, many means. And part of it, as a scientist, you stop even hearing it as jargon. You know, we learned it so long ago, and it's become part of our vocabulary with its special meaning, that we don't even know we're saying it. And so that's a big one. But I think, too, really, it's back to something we talked about earlier. It's that listening part. If I'm giving a lecture, or if I'm talking to my barista at Starbucks, if I'm paying attention, I know when I lose them. I know when I've gone off the rails. And if I'm not paying attention, then I miss it. And I just lecture, I monologue about whatever it is my point was. And most of the time, it's pointless.
Well, let's turn it around from the other end. You have a lot of interactions with the media because you live in one of the media capitals of the world, Southern California, Los Angeles there. What are some of the things that you observe there with, sometimes reporters or journalists that that you can also tell are not exactly the best practices?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I counted them up in the past, and I've done thousands of interviews by this point in my career. And I can remember like one or two times ever when a reporter has tried to trip me up or get me to say something I didn't want to say. We think of reporters like in the movies, you know, when somebody's coming out of the courthouse and all the microphones are in their face, right? But that's not how scientists interact with the press. By and large, most reporters are just trying to figure out what we're talking about. They're not really hostile. I think, you know, a lot of my colleagues, they have this idea that they're going to be misquoted. But in my experience, when scientists are misquoted, it's usually because they said something that didn't make any sense. And I've really found working with reporters, working with the media, being on your show, Dave, has always been a joy and always been worthwhile. So I like doing it, and I wish more of my colleagues would do more of it too.
Is there anything you think could be improved along those lines to help scientists, like say at a place like the Jet Propulsion Laboratory or institutions like that that have scientists, to give them more structured preparation to, like, you know, be intentional, as you were just talking about, when they do interact with the public and the press?
Yeah, for sure. I think to me, the most important thing is to do it, is to practice. But also, you know, just to come back a third time to this idea of a dialogue, it's much easier to talk to a reporter when you know something about the reporter, right? If I understand where you're coming from, you know, that you operate on deadlines that are inconceivable in my world, you know, for a scientist, a deadline is, well, you know, in 3 or 4 weeks, we have to send our response to the reviewers back. And then a couple of months from now, you know, maybe we'll get some more feedback, or maybe we'll get our paper published. That's the time scale. And, you know, when I'm writing proposals, time scales are like that. If you're reporting the news, your time scale is this afternoon, you know, your deadline is now. And I think as I've gotten to know more and more reporters and understand their job better, it's made it easier for me to trust reporters and to talk. And I think at the end of the day, it's that dialogue thing, you know, when we're really having a back and forth instead of me just monologuing, then everything's better for both of us.
Okay, well, is there anything you want to ask me then?
I do, as a matter of fact, Dave. You know, a lot of people, I think, you know, realize, even though I'm doing all this talking, you're really the one doing all the work here, right? Because I'm just talking about stuff I've known for decades, but you have to be an expert on a new thing every episode. So here's my question, Dave. I've known some of the people that you've interviewed, you know, my pal Bill Patzert, and when they come on your show, they're so interesting sounding. How do you make them sound so good?
Well, I think that's innate, you know, that they have to be interesting to begin with. But a lot of it is just to...
I don't know. I know some of them. They're definitely more interesting on your show, Dave.
Well, thank you. I think part of it is just I have tremendous enthusiasm for what I do, and I'm interested in your work. And I want to know more about it because I think I want to share that with our audience. And so I think, you know, I'm guessing that some of it's just, you know, my enthusiasm and passion for what I'm doing rubs off on them. And I think also a lot of times people get very nervous. You know, they worry about what they're going to sound like. Am I going to make a mistake? And, you know, we're not here to do ambush journalism, certainly. And so, you know, just trying to get everybody to feel comfortable and to have a fun interaction. I always tell people that are going to be on the show, it's like, just pretend you're talking to me at a coffee house or, you know, over a beer, and we're just having a conversation, and there just happens to be somebody listening in behind us. You know, let them enjoy the conversation.
I love that. I think it's great. I can tell too. I've always known this about you. You do homework. You definitely do your homework before you get here.
Yes. That's one thing that's the hidden part of the show. You know, people hear me, but it's like an iceberg, Josh. You ever heard of those?
I have.
Yeah.
I have.
Well, most of what I do is hours and hours of research, reading, background, you know, so that I understand what my guest is working on and have some, you know, grasp of it. It helps that I have my own backgrounds in the sciences, so I'm familiar with a lot of the jargon, as it were, and a lot of times I find myself, it's jargon. I better, see if I can put that into plain words so that my audience understands what that person just said. But yeah, just a tremendous amount of research goes into, finding out about what this person does, their background, where they came from, and what their work is and why it's important, and reading their work, just spending a lot of time with it so that when we do talk, I'm not going off really a script. I'm just, using all of that stuff that I assimilated in those few days before I have a conversation with somebody like you. And then when something comes up, it's like, oh yeah, okay, I know about that. I'll ask about this.
I love that. I think it's great. I find that incredibly flattering, that you would take the time to be interested in what I'm doing and think about it. I know some of my colleagues might be terrified because it feels like that departmental exam that I failed, all those years ago in physics.
Yes.
But I know it comes from a place of shared interest and enthusiasm, and that's what makes it fun.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to a longtime friend of Blue Dot, NASA oceanographer and climate scientist Josh Willis. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our visit with Josh Willis. Josh is an oceanographer and climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. His background in theater and improv also makes him the ideal guest to talk about what can seem to be an overwhelming subject, climate change and Earth's warming, acidifying, and rising oceans.
Climate change affects us all already. This isn't something that is 10 or 20 years in the future, it's now. And it's going to affect the next generations even more. They're going to have to adapt to some of it. And hopefully we're going to find ways to avoid the worst parts of climate change. But it's late. The hour is late, Dave. We have a lot of work to do, and we need to do it really quickly.
Yes, it's that clock is ticking, and we don't seem to actually be doing the hard work that it will take to avoid the worst of it. Do you get frustrated? I imagine you do. I know I do. When you look at such a large part of the United States population that, actively, has a lifestyle that basically is like, I don't care. I'm going to blow through as much carbon as I want to. I'm having a good time.
Yeah, it's frustrating, I think, to see attitudes of worse than flippancy, like we're doing this no matter what. Belligerence, I think, is closer to the right word. But at the end of the day, I feel like we have we have to solve this problem at a global scale, and that means it needs a political solution. It's really not right to ask every citizen to fix this problem like individually by themselves. We have to legislate it. And, some people are not going to like that, and it's against their business interests, and they're going to fight it. But at the end of the day, we have to solve it politically. And sure, you should try to make low carbon choices as best you can, but we need help. You can't do it alone.
I think there's also a sense of, for the average person, you're trying to get through your day, you're trying to take care of your kids, feed them, clothe them, keep a roof over their head, and enjoy life as best you can. It can get kind of overwhelming when you start, you know, thinking about all that.
That's right. And I don't think it's right to put all that on an individual. You know, the problem was created collectively by governments, by corporations, with the promise of a lot of benefits, which have been great. You know, it's I can turn on my air conditioning and prevent myself from dying in the 120 degree heat. But it has a price, right? And we're paying some of that price right now. So we have to solve it as a society in the long run. And I think, you know, sometimes the personal choice thing gets too much emphasis, and we really need to be thinking about solutions that come at a legislative level.
Yes, because, you know, no matter how much you recycle or don't drive as much and all those things, you know, are good. But, you know, at the same time, it's not just on each individual. Like you said, we have to do it together, and not just together as a country, but as a world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know,
some people don't like that. They like their nationalism.
Right. Right. And individualism. And I get that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, we got in this mess together, so we have to get out of it together.
Exactly. Well, what's the future like for you as a scientist? What are some of the things that you're actively working on now, you know, that you're excited about?
Well, we're going to launch a new version of this satellite, the one that got me my PhD. It's called Sentinel 6B. In a little over a year, in November, and it's going to carry this record forward another 5 years, and probably a Sentinel 6C after that. But the future is really bright for the study of the oceans right now. In addition to these really cool satellites that I've been working on forever, there's new ones like the SWOT mission, Surface Water and Ocean Topography, which actually give us a super high resolution look at the sea level. You know, this radar I described earlier has been telling us about the global sea levels and what sea level looks like for things like El Nino and La Nina, which cover, you know, a huge area in the Pacific Ocean. But this one actually shows us all the fine little details in the oceans, and also in lakes and rivers. So we're going to learn a lot about flooding and how water is moving around on the surface of the ocean, of the earth, which is really important for things like flooding, water use, and it has really all kinds of applications. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
And obviously you didn't get to name the satellite, because you would have come up with something a lot funnier.
Yeah.
Do you ever sit around and think, like, you know, come up with a list of names if I could only name the satellite?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. But
you'll have to share that list with me privately, because I don't want to get you fired.
I will for sure.
Speaking of where you work, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, a NASA center, it just amazes me the incredible scope of work that's done there. Because literally they study, scientists like yourself study everything from the smallest things to the oceans, to the, you know, the volcanoes, earthquakes, and out into space, Mars, the planets, galaxies. It's just astonishing all of the things that go on at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. It must be just a joy to work at a place like that.
It is fun. There's always some wacky thing going on. And in fact, actually, it's interesting, too, because JPL operates what's called the Deep Space Network, which is a set of antennas pointed outward that collect data from all the NASA satellites and send commands back. So one of our recent directors, a man named Charles Alachi, he actually, all of the data from all these satellites goes through a single room on the lab at JPL. It sort of looks like a mission control kind of place, like you see in the movies. And it's literally talking to satellites like the Voyager satellites that have left the solar system, telescopes looking at the farthest edges of the universe. And all that data comes through this one room. So he deemed it the center of the universe. And there's a big seal right in the middle of the room with an X on it that says center of the universe. So when you're lucky and you get led onto the floor, you can go stand at the center of the universe and take a selfie, which is pretty cool.
Well, Climate Elvis, Josh Willis, one of my favorite oceanographers in the world, from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. It's always a joy to talk to you. Thanks for spending some time with us to tell us about your career and your work and the state of the oceans right now, because they are expanding and sea level is rising.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to our guest, NASA JPL oceanographer Josh Willis. You can learn more about Josh's work on the Oceans Melting Greenland program at omg.jpl.nasa.gov. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.